You're listening to 99.1 WQRT LP, and welcome to Radio Free Book Club for August 2023. I'm Ken Honeywell. I'm a writer and reader from Indianapolis, and today we're talking about a first novel from D.K. Nuro, the provocatively titled What Napoleon Could Not Do. It's Nuro's first novel. He's a graduate of the Iowa Writers Workshop and currently curator of special projects at the University of Iowa Stanley Museum of Art. Nuro was born in Ghana, came to America at the age of 11, and his novel has a lot to say on the subject of what America means to blacks on both sides of the Atlantic. The story revolves around the NT family and the siblings Jacob and Belinda, who are both in pursuit of some kind of American dream, and Belinda's husband Wilder, for whom the dream becomes kind of a nightmare. And there's a lot to talk about here, so thank goodness we've assembled an insightful crew of Radio Free Book Club members to discuss it, and I'd love for them to introduce themselves. Hello, Tracy.
Hello, Ken. I am Tracy Kumbe, a writer and recently a bike rider in Indianapolis.
Nice. Do you have a new bike? Is your son involved in that in some way?
He has encouraged me, yes. It's delightful. I didn't know.
Yeah. I'm with you on that one. All right. Barb.
I'm Barb Shoup. I'm a novelist and the writer in residence at the Indiana Writers Center. And I fell off my bike last summer, so I haven't been back on it again, but maybe I will. I do remember the delight of it, though.
Yeah, one of my favorite things. Thank you, Barb. And we have our first family affair book club here with our newest member, Kate. Hello and welcome.
Hi, I'm Kate Shoup. I'm Barb's daughter. Things could get dicey.
we're hoping
they have in the past.
Fingers crossed. I am also a writer, but I write the boring kind of books, and I also work do some freelance editing work, and I'm kind of a moonlighting motorsports photographer.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Kate. We're glad you're here.
Thanks.
And then before we get started, as usual, we will be spoiling What Napoleon Could Not Do, so fair warning. There's a lot of stuff here you're not going to want to know if you plan to read the book. The good news is you can find this and all the episodes of Radio Free Book Club on Mixcloud and on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, just about anywhere you stream podcasts. So give it a read, come back and listen at another time, and maybe right now you could listen to another one of WQRT's fine programs instead. I also, before we get started, I want to make a brief pitch for our esteemed producer, Oreo Jones's big event called Trice. It's a huge hip-hop festival that's happening in Indy's Fountain Square Cultural District on Saturday, August 26th. If you're listening to this in August of 2023, you should run out and find a ticket now. if you're listening after that, well, it's a really great show. And we hope you can get to the next one. So, okay, let's get started. Who wants to give us a little bit more of a setup about of what Napoleon Could Not Do? Maybe talk a little bit about it, the structure of the novel. Tracy, you're usually a pretty dependable voice.
I was afraid I was going to get called out there, actually. Okay, so we have, as you said, the siblings. It starts off with a divorce proceeding in Ghana. We go through the sister Belinda's life in America and some trauma in Vietnam for her husband, and then trauma back in Ghana. I feel like is basically the structure of the novel.
Yeah.
A lot of trauma.
Close enough. A lot of trauma.
So it's a family story and a story about immigration and, as you were saying, what it means to be black in Ghana, what it means to be black in America, from a lot of different perspectives.
Yeah, I think that's great. The principal characters, as we said, were the two siblings, Jacob and Belinda's husband, Wilder. Their family, I should say, in Ghana were also important. Mr. NT and Jacob's older brother, Robert, and his wife, whose name I'm forgetting right now, Martha, I believe it was, and their son, Alfred, around whom the story really, part of it revolved. And interestingly, I read listened to a brief interview with the author who said his original idea for the book started with Alfred.
I think I heard that same interview. He was talking about how a child in Ghana would not be heard from. They would be expected to be silent. But Alfred was in the impossible position of having two deaf parents, and he had to be the voice.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, interesting. He certainly wasn't the principal character of the book. Yeah, you can see how he started there. So, what'd y'all think, Kate? What are your impressions of the book?
So, I did not love it, and there were times when I just wasn't quite sure what it was about. But I almost felt like that might even be a thematic trick because I felt like so much of the book was about identity and trying to find one's place, that it almost felt like I might be experiencing what some of the characters were experiencing. But I also kind of thought about how so many books are written with an audience that's like me in mind. And I'm saying that as a white woman. And in some ways, I think this book was written for someone else. And I'm glad that there are books for someone else. And I guess in the end, I just kind of went away feeling like I don't think I was the audience for that book. I'm glad other people are an audience for that book and that that audience is being served in a way perhaps it has not been in the past.
Yeah.
You know what? Two things about that. First of all, that's what my son Miles said after he saw the Barbie movie. He came home and he said, "I don't think that was for me." It's like, I don't know. I think it's for everybody. But also, to your point, I will cop to the fact that I chose this book. And I chose
it. Thanks a lot, Tracy.
I knew.
Say why.
Well, because I didn't think it was for me. And I thought that would be interesting. I don't know a damn thing about Ghana. I don't know about what it's like to grow up there in a family like that. I don't know what it's like to immigrate to the United States. So I was very interested in all that. But it did, I think, hold me at arm's length a little bit.
Yeah, how so?
I thought it was very much a challenge to relate to these characters. And I don't know, I didn't take it as a trick or something illustrative of the experience these characters were having. I just thought they kind of sucked.
Well, okay.
As people or as characters?
Both. I mean, we start with Jacob, and he's just lazy and ineffectual, and I didn't really care about what was going to happen to him because he didn't seem to. So I had similar feelings for most of the characters in the book. Albert was great. Albert's adorable.
Albert was great. Yeah.
And you know, I would have loved for this book to be about Patricia's mother. Patricia's mother had some gumption.
Yes. I thought she was funny. She was so mouthy and so in control and so powerful. I would agree that that would have been a more interesting character for me for sure.
All right. I have some questions about that. But Barb, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm kind of where you guys are. I felt like the most interesting person to me was Wilder. That was a Vietnam story I had not heard. And I've read, you know, a lot of stuff from that era. And I just thought that was really a fascinating story. Jacob, he just wasn't interesting to me at all. And I felt like I don't know what exactly he was trying to do with the sexual thing because he was, you know, in the S&M and all that. But it didn't work. I mean, it didn't offend me so much as I just thought, and why? I mean, what does that mean in the context of this story? It just didn't really mean anything. And so I just didn't, you know, find that particularly. It didn't help my understanding of the character, I guess. And I think everything about a character should help you understand them more. And I thought Belinda's story was pretty cliche in a way. Mm-hmm. You know, smart girl, gets the money to go to the United States. And, you know, the nice irony that the American husband's background is what keeps her from getting the green card. That's pretty weird. But it wasn't a particularly unusual story. And she wasn't a particularly lovable character either. So I agree. I thought the scene, that first scene, which is really from the father's point of view, yes. when they come for the dissolution of the marriage, was just fabulous. I mean, everything about it was wonderful. The uncle and how the father encouraged that, you know, what was his name? Tot, who had been right. off the wagon to, you know, to drink the ceremonial liquor, which, of course, was going to send him right into a spin. And he knew it. So that, I thought that was absolutely fascinating. And actually, I thought Patricia was interesting when we finally actually got to meet her. Mm-hmm. So it didn't hang together for me very well.
Well, I would like to talk about the characters, but first I just have a kind of a different question. Do we think differently about a first novel? Do we cut the writer some slack? Do we, in any way, or do we engage everything the same?
This guy teaches novel writing at the premier writer's workshop in the country.
He does.
I cut him zero slack.
Okay. That's what I'm asking.
I would agree. I mean, I think if you want to write a novel, then, and you want to have it published and you want people to love it, then I think no matter how many you've written, whether it's one or 30, you have the same obligation to ensure that it holds, that it hangs together. I don't cut anybody any slack.
To me, it's not a question of cutting any slack. It was so obvious to me that it was a first novel. I didn't even know it was a first novel. But as soon as I got into it, I thought, this is a first novel. You know, this is what a lot of people do. It just reflected. I look at a lot of people's novels because I do editing for people who are working on novels. And I could just see a lot of the kind of mistakes that some people make. And I think it's unfortunate that maybe an editor didn't help him pull that together a little bit more. Because I felt like it was all over the place. I don't know what it was about, you know.
Yeah, I would agree. I could see certain things that could be left out and certain things that could be enhanced. And if you had done those things, it would have mm-hmm. worked. Like you said about the whole piece with his sexuality and even the conceit of the child. Was it Albert or Alfred?
Alfred. Sorry. Alfred.
You know, like it felt to me like him dying was just this vehicle to bring Belinda back. It almost didn't even matter when it happened.
Right.
Like it just, there was not a lot of him. I didn't feel anything when I wanted to feel something, and I just felt like there were might have been ways to plant those seeds and pull it together, and it didn't happen.
I agree with you that wasn't earned,
right?
It just happened. Yeah,
it's interesting. Has anyone read Burnham Wood? You've read Burnham Wood.
I have not read Burnham.
I did. I did. That's my recommendation.
Yeah. Oh, good. I want to hear about it more. But we had that conversation last month about whether, and I think Dan Barden and Susan Neville both thought that some of these, you know, plot devices were pretty obvious, that someone had to die at a certain point, and so they had to die just for the sake of the plot. But yeah, I think that's an interesting observation about this, too, is that, I mean, did Alfred have to die just so Belinda would have to go back to Ghana? Probably.
I mean, except for that she didn't go when her mother died.
Well, yeah. So, let's talk about that for a minute.
Well, I think she didn't go when her mother died because of the green card. She was afraid she couldn't get back.
Yeah, and then once at the point that the child died, you had the understanding that Wilder, her husband, was also interested in
moving.
Yes, yeah. Right. So I guess that's different.
But I think he always would have gone. I think that was part of the point, was that she was determined to not go back because she was determined to not allow America to defeat her. Or, you know, to give up her American dream, even though it's not what she always hoped it was going to be.
Right. And I didn't really feel why she, I didn't feel what she, what we were supposed to feel, that she felt for the boy. I didn't, you know,
agreed.
I
mean,
she
was sending everybody.
She'd never met him. She sent him shoes.
Yeah, she sent, right.
But neither had Jacob and Patricia ever met.
Right. True.
Right.
Well, but that didn't go well either.
Yeah, well, they also didn't feel anything. That's true. But I think, you know, the child, that she would be attached to a child is a different kind of an attachment. And I might have believed that if it had been, I don't know, if we'd had something more than what we had. I was very surprised that would be the thing in her mind that would make her go back. I have to go back for that.
Yeah. Well, let's talk for a minute about the characters. Whose story do we think this is? It kind of starts off, it seems like, as Jacob's story. But, I mean, ultimately, we probably know more about Belinda than we do about Jacob. And we probably know a lot more about Wilder than about any of them.
Right.
So who's the protagonist here?
I don't think there is one.
I don't either.
And I think that's a problem. You know, a friend of mine who is a wonderful writer said of multiple point of view books, the reader is going to decide, you know, whether you think there's a point of view character or one, a main character or not, the reader will, and they'll usually agree on which character it is. And I couldn't, and I think we need that, you know, the story has to circle around somebody. And then the other points of view are there to underpin that and enlighten it. And I just felt like they were three really separate stories, and that none of them stood out as the main character for me.
If I had to pick one, though, I think I would pick Belinda, because she seemed to be the one that was involved with all of the other ancillary voices. And also, she seems to be the cause of the title. She's the one who the father always says has done what Napoleon could not do. And so, but it confused me because it didn't start with her. And right. So that made it more difficult for me to identify who that main character might be. But I'm not saying that I think she was the main character, but if I had to pick one, mm-hmm. that would be who I would say.
Tracy?
Agreed.
Well, that's, I mean, you make an interesting point when you say she's the one who was engaged with everybody. And, you know, if you had made her the point of view character and, you know, that other stuff could have come in by way of flashback and all kinds of things. And you know, she was very disturbed and guilty about her relationship with her brother. And that was potentially a really powerful moment, you know, when they would, but that never really exactly happened. You know, it was like she said, trick him into believing it's his idea and then I'll feel better. You know? So it wasn't really played out.
No, but you know what I think one of the pleasures of this novel is that when the perspectives shift, you do get a really nice, fuller sense of the character. I will say that Belinda was not who I thought she was once we got in her head a little bit. And Wilder certainly was not. And I find that to be so delightful when I'm reading a novel.
I like
and
it
I'm
too.
Just rolling along. I'm believing whatever Jacob's telling me. And then I see, oh, well, hang on.
Maybe.
A little something more here.
Yeah. I like that too. And I think there were interesting things to think about. For sure. Mm-hmm. I thought the relationship that Belinda had with what was her name? I can't think of her name. The girl from
Edith.
Edith. Yeah. I mean, that was a weird relationship.
Indeed,
and her dad was, you know, kind of in the middle of it. And then it turns out he's getting people to pay him to do the stuff that she thought he had done as a favor. So that whole world was interesting, you know, that you could have a person like the dad who could wield this kind of power to get this kid or another kid. And maybe he could have gotten Jacob, but didn't want to. We don't really know that. What was that about? And then the other wealthy friend that she also had. I thought it was a bit of a stretch that Belinda's that one of the girls from Hotchkiss turned out to be Sims.
I have that on page 4 of my tight notes.
Excellent. Well done, Kate.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was a pretty, that was, if there was anything I was going to roll my eyes at, that was for sure.
Well, and then nothing happened. It didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, it didn't
go
anywhere.
Like if it had been some way that then Belinda discovered his proclivities and then that had some relevance to her or to the story, then obviously that would have worked. But it just was like just dangling there.
It was,
Okay, so let's talk about Jacob.
Okay.
Let's go, just go all there with Jacob. Was he really feckless?
Yes.
Okay. I guess I shouldn't ask no questions.
Next question, Ken.
Well, I feel like he just didn't have a sense of purpose. You know, he had some skills. But he didn't really seem to want to work very hard.
But wasn't his purpose go to America?
Which is interesting because his purpose was go to America, but that kept him from being able to have a purpose where he was. And so...
Was that even his purpose, or was that kind of handed to him as a purpose?
Well, that's an interesting question, too, because he didn't really seem...
He didn't seem to care.
Yeah, that...
It seemed he was in a stasis. He seemed stuck.
Yeah.
And so I think if I were in his position, I might have imagined that I shouldn't start anything because any minute I might have to pick up and go to America, which is my quote-unquote destiny based on this arranged marriage. But I can understand being a little bit stuck in his situation, but I also found that frustrating because I just generally find it frustrating when people don't
act. He was also 35 years old when his marriage was arranged,
right?
like that. So he'd been hanging around for quite some time.
Yeah, and living with his family, which I don't know what that means in that
world.
Seems
normal because
it's normal
brother and
the deaf brother.
Yes,
That you know, that's an interesting thing too. The deaf brother and wife. What was the purpose of that? You know what. Did you know you're making up characters? They weren't deaf until you decided they were. And
well, again, I think that's where he started, and maybe that was something that he didn't need.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what it added. I mean, I guess to me it added just interest to the story. I was kind of taken with all the stuff in Ghana.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah,
I was kind of
too.
Into the whole environment, and I could just kind of see it.
It's like a vestigial tale, you know, like where you've got this leftover quality in a character that you had at the beginning, but then as you got going, they didn't necessarily need it anymore, but you wanted to hang on to it.
Well, and I think if he had done more with Alfred, that was really interesting because Alfred had to be there.
Yeah.
You know, he had to be the person who spoke for them, and that made him an unusual person, but we didn't get enough of that to...
Well, but it also made his loss even greater.
Yes.
To everyone. Yeah.
Right. I thought it was pretty interesting that that Jacob ended up with the post woman, Philomena. And I was glad, you know. I mean, apparently they were right together on the whole, you know, sexual thing. And
well,
more
she
power
had to be coaxed
to
into it,
them.
I think.
I don't know. I thought there was maybe a bit of hope for some kind of a happiness or a relationship. Maybe there.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But it was a something.
I'm going to throw this out. Tracy, does his sexual proclivities help explain his torpor?
No.
Is that an excuse for...
No. I don't find that to be an excuse. And it doesn't even make sense. I mean, isn't the... prevailing, what's the word I'm looking for? Theory that like people like to be dominated or hurt, abused, whatever, because they're in power and they want to give it up. He had no power. So what was he going for there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks for the analysis there, Tracy.
Well done.
I'm here for you for these things.
Awesome. I'm going to do something I never do and say, you're listening to Radio Free Book Club, and we're talking about D.K. Nuro's What Napoleon Could Not Do. So this book was broken into a bunch of sections. Let's see if we can figure them out. There was the divorce ceremony. Mm-hmm. There was a Jacob, mostly Jacob section. There was a Belinda section.
There was a very brief Alfred section.
Right, right. An Alfred section. There was a Belinda section. There was the Wilder section.
Right.
There was a very short section where basically Wilder's ghosts were grabbing hold of him. And then there was the end where we went to the funeral in Ghana. Right. So was there any one of those or any several of those that you kind of felt more interested in or just more engaged with while you're reading? Anybody?
I think for me it was the Wilder section, and maybe that was because that was like a point of entry that I could access, but also because I think it just created such an interesting tension for me, the way that Belinda and really everybody in the Ghana portion of the story was so desperate to come to America and belong in America. And meanwhile, Wilder, who was born in America as an African American, had a little bit of an unusual background insofar as that he had been raised in relative wealth, but all he wanted was to get out. And so I found his section to be the most compelling because I could get a handle on that. I knew enough context to be able to understand what his story was about.
Yeah, Barb?
I felt like that was kind of the most organic section, i.e. the other characters sort of felt to me like, you know, sometimes in writing classes, people would say, make a character profile, you know, and I felt like those characters had been worked out ahead, but they didn't work, you know, because they never lifted. Whereas I thought Wilder's didn't feel that way to me. I thought it felt more authentic and more, I don't know, kind of paradoxical, and it had interesting sort of conflicting things in it, which the others didn't really have, which feels more like real life to me. It's you know, it was a mess.
This is so interesting. So I loved the divorce scene in the opening.
Oh, me too.
That had a lot of life in it, and it was just so outside of my experience, I couldn't quite figure out what was going on. I couldn't figure out who these people were. I had no idea yet. And it was delightful to see that unfold. And then, you know, of course, Patricia's mother is a bull in a china shop. But Wilder, man, I thought that section was never going to end.
Oh, you really?
I couldn't get engaged with it. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. That is interesting.
What'd you think, Ken? Where'd you land?
Well, I loved the first section. I thought it was really, I mean, it takes a minute to get to shift your brain into that world. But once I could shift my brain, I really enjoyed that. And the stuff with Jacob, I thought his sexual stuff was just weird. And I'm not really sure why it was even there, what it added to the character or to the story. But the world with the internet cafe and Benjamin and Alfred and the circle of churches and the vans and the lady with the beans, and it was all just kind of really fascinating to me. The Vietnam stuff, I thought, was really interesting right up until he got to Laos and lived with Vatsana for however long he lived, for the 5 years or whatever he spent living and hiding in Laos. I did not find that particularly interesting.
Yeah, that magical realism piece was not as interesting to me either. Mm-hmm. I agree with that.
The magical realism stuff didn't do anything for me, but I actually did think it was pretty interesting how he got there and what the world was like there, and that I believed that relationship that he had with her. And I thought that the thing with the little girl was really interesting too, that he became so attached to that little girl, May, and that what happened to her was so traumatic that he never got over that. So I totally believed that. And I believed to an extent that they would still be present to him in, you know, after he was gone. But mainly I just thought what happened there I thought was pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I felt like that was where he turned. Before Vietnam, he is still in the mode of, you know, he kind of believes that he can he can escape the color of his skin in an America where that's just not possible. And when he meets the other African-Americans in his platoon, and they have had such different experiences because they weren't surrounded by wealth or insulated by wealth the way that he was, and that slow change, and that eventually culminates with the death of Martin Luther King, and he's just horrified that that's what it takes for him to understand what that's like. And I think there's a part where it says, a new soul had made a home in him, a fiery one that had pushed his original one from its chair. And I liked that I could see that transition, and it made sense to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought he was, by the way, all that stuff about Mejia, is true. Like, that's an actual town with where there was a big oil field, and three young black men were, the Juneteenth incident. Yes, died after being taken into custody, drowned on their way to jail, arrested for marijuana charges. But was there also an implication that he had some mental illness? The exploding fruit heads that he kept seeing when he was in Mejia, and when he went to college, and then it started happening again until the actual head exploded. I mean, he seemed to have some kind of mental illness slash, you know, he fit fine into the magical realism parts of the story.
As a person who is really deeply familiar with watching a person go through a psychotic episode, I did not pick that up. But okay. I mean, yeah, I could see where, I guess to me, when
he talked about a mental institution in Mejia and.
Yeah. I mean, I can see what you're saying. I guess for me, at least in my experience, it's more consuming than what he experienced. I mean, I think to me, I feel like what he was experiencing was maybe an artifact of some kind of earlier trauma, more than a mental illness per se, but that's just my.
And I think, you know, PTSD from the whole Vietnam thing, I think he certainly suffered from that.
For sure. But there was some implication prior that he had some. And I will also say I have the advantage of having read this twice. And so
cheater.
I know. I feel like it's an obligation. Yeah, well, I think it's interesting that at least two of us, maybe three of us, think Belinda was the protagonist, or there wasn't a protagonist. I don't know if there was one, it was Belinda. But we didn't mention any of Belinda's sections of the story when talking about the most interesting parts of the story. And right. That seems to be an issue.
Yeah. Yes, agreed.
I would have loved if the story had moved like I thought it was going to move, into how Jacob dealt with this, and how I got into it in the first place, but from his point of view, and you know, to carry him through to whatever that was, whether it was the brother-in-law and the, you know, bringing light to Ghana or whatever. But I always feel like, you know, that first chapter, or really the first page of something, you're setting up a promise to the reader. And whether the reader is aware of it or you, the writer, are aware of it, it's there. And if that promise isn't fulfilled in the end, then it's an unsatisfying experience. And I felt like that set me up for something completely different from what the book turned out to be.
Well, so go ahead, Tracy.
Oh, no.
No, I was going to say, so let me just pile a question on that. So the first section, actually the first word, if you say the title of the first section is the first word, is worth. Mm-hmm. There's a lot about worth in the book. There's a lot of questions about the worth of America, the worth of me as a black man in America.
Well, and the worth of Wilder, because he has so much money.
Right.
But also, but going back to what we were talking about, the main character issue, and in that divorce scene, the brother's wife, Kwame Brony's wife, does say, I do think there is a big elephant we are ignoring, America. Perhaps it's the real culprit. Perhaps it's the entity deserving of blame. And for me, ultimately, that seemed to be what he was trying to do with the book, was to demonstrate the hypocrisy of America and the tension between the way people who don't live here view it as such a land of opportunity, but that opportunity is only for very few. And also the tension of people who are here and who are denied the opportunity that this country promises. And I think ultimately for me, that was, I think that's what he,
I think you're, that,
what the book
that's
was about.
Good. Yeah, I think that's right. That's interesting.
Tracy, what do you think?
I can't argue that. Yeah, I think that sounds right.
And you were married to an immigrant. I am married to an immigrant. Mm-hmm. You're immigrant.
The other side of Africa.
I know he has his own identity, but his family. How difficult was it for them to gain citizenship here?
It was a challenge to get here. His father, he came from some major power in Eritrea.
Oh, okay.
So that they helps. Had their way smoothed a little bit, but it broke his dad coming here because he had been such a big man in Eritrea. He came to Portland, Oregon, and was nobody.
Yeah.
You know, he was a black man in America, and it broke him.
Yeah. So, like, in my case, my immigrant is from France, but and that is a country where, because of the, I mean, let's just say racial makeup, I mean, he's white. It was still hard for him to actually obtain a green card here. It took him, his green card arrived in the mail 10 years to the day of when he arrived in this country. Mm-hmm. But for him, it's, as he says, he's just here for the women and the money. So it's gone well.
Yeah.
You know, woohoo.
Yeah. Well, but you know, I, again, going back to the little bit of interview that sounds like Tracy and I both heard, you know, the author said, made a point that to a lot of people in Ghana, he said Ghana particularly, America is the prize, and you will compromise a lot of things for America. Even love you will compromise for America. So did he not love Pamela? I mean, how could he have known he loved Pamela when they got engaged?
Oh, you mean Patricia?
I'm sorry, Patricia.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, how could he have known? But that's a compromise.
Right.
Yeah.
And a compromise Belinda made as well.
Yeah, absolutely. To never actually get what she wanted. I mean, she was someone who had everything going for her. You know, the education, the rich husband, the skills, you know, but America was denied her as well.
Yeah, and I think it was made especially painful because of the fact that she did everything right. You know, she was extremely educated. She was married to an American, and then the irony, of course, of her marriage being probably the main reason she was unable to obtain a green card.
Yeah.
But she actually says, "Let's show you how much you are not one of us, Belinda. A full-fledged American can't even make it happen for you." And I think that was a really powerful line and probably a feeling that a lot of people experience, because it's just really, we make it really difficult, and it's very unfortunate because we're missing out on the talents of so many interesting people, you know.
So Wilder was really filled with rage. Was his rage understandable?
It was to me.
Yeah.
I thought so. And like we talked about earlier, the awakening, well, the Juneteenth incident and the awakening of it. But to me, it made total sense that, first of all, he felt he had been duped. You know, he had sort of moved through the world believing that he was, that money could sort of insulate him from.
Well, he was told he was almost as good as a white guy.
Right. Exactly. And I think that, you know, the character named Conley, who was in his platoon and made the point of, he says, "I needed 2 days to think on the question, which one I prefer to kill me, the Viet Cong or the white man." And I think
that was a really big
turning point for him, was the realization there's just no way of escaping it. And I think for me, that would make me enraged for sure.
Well, I mean, I guess I sort of feel the rage of any black person makes sense to me.
Absolutely.
Any black person who's not enraged, I can't really imagine that.
Right. And I think it's interesting to pit Belinda, who's used to a place where the lights go off all the time and is more willing to give America some slack, next to this husband who has been in America most of his life and has some grievances, some very justified grievances.
Well, I thought his opinion about Obama, I mean, the election of Obama was really interesting.
I thought that too.
In his mind, the worst thing that could happen, because whatever was going to happen after that was going to be really bad.
I wonder if that was something that was actually in the air. I mean, it's easy to say in retrospect.
Yeah.
But I would be interested to know if that was a common opinion.
I would too.
Speaking of Obama, I noticed that he had this book on his most recent list of books.
Oh, really?
But the other thing I thought was interesting was the portrait in the wedding scene when Belinda's portrait gallery, that artist
Black Jesus.
Is the same artist that did the Obama portrait where he's in the greenery.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked that artist up and, oh, my God. There are just some beautiful, incredible pieces by that artist. And so,
Kehinde Wiley.
Yes, thank you. And I was so grateful. I didn't love this book, but it was wonderful to make that connection, because just coincidentally, I had been in Washington, D.C. like the week before I read this book, and I saw that Obama painting, and it was just spectacular in person. And just to be introduced to that artist in that way was really neat. His style is to take this sort of like almost Renaissance, I don't know. It's like he would put African-American people in a more like classical settings, and they're just absolutely beautiful. So I was really happy to be introduced to that artist through this book.
Yeah. Again, the author's a curator at the museum in Iowa. So, yeah, interesting. Well, let's talk a little bit about the magical stuff in Laos for a minute. What did we think of that? How did that fit, that, you know, kind of magical realism, you know, kind of ending, kind of tacked on to what was certainly a much more realistic story up to that point? Anybody?
I mean, I had to interpret it as just Wilder working to explain what he'd been through and what he was feeling. He was not a man who was particularly open to emotion, and for good reason, he had a terrible time. But I felt like that was just a way, instead of grieving and instead of saying, okay, this hurts, to make it a problem outside himself. This woman was pulling on me. You know, these people are pulling on me. They're guiding my life. And so, no, I didn't think there was any sort of truth to that. I thought it was just a long way to go not to feel as much pain as was really there.
Yeah. So there was no real magic in Laos, right?
I didn't think that there was. I just thought it was just an incredibly powerful connection that he felt to her, but those two worlds were just never going to be able to come together. So I get, you know, the pull in a almost literal way that he would be pulled by what he had been left, what he had left behind. And
if you're an angry person and you're in a position in a country that you don't particularly like, it's pretty easy to idealize something you have back.
Yeah.
You left behind.
So, again, was Wilder then when he came home, was that just part of his PTSD? Was that some kind of mental illness of his? Was that a coping mechanism? We don't think there was anything real magic going on there when he got home. Kate?
I didn't.
I agree with what you're saying and what you've said. Yeah, to me, it just, first of all, I just don't as an aside, I don't just generally enjoy magical realism anyway, but it didn't do anything for me, and I didn't feel like it made sense. If it was, in fact, magical realism, I felt like it shouldn't have, it didn't make sense in the context of the
book for me. Right, you don't have to shoehorn it in
yes.
the chapter.
And that's part of why I came to the conclusion that you just described, which was, as you said, and as Tracy said, a coping mechanism mm-hmm. to think about, a way to think about this thing so that you don't have to ingest it all the way.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the ending. Everybody goes to Ghana, and Wilder is going to light up Ghana, which is another, you know, another thing that we at least ought to touch on is the idea of light is a kind of a recurring motif throughout the book. Anybody have anything to say about any of that?
I wanted to say two things about it. One was I think there was a real clear use of light as a way to describe America in contrast to Ghana. America was a place where the lights were always on, and Ghana was a place where they weren't. But there's also a line toward the end where Wilder's communicating with Robert, who is the deaf brother, and he says, "What was Belinda like when she was younger?" And Robert writes, "Sharper than the splendor of our present midday light." And Wilder says, "That can be its own burden." And Robert said, "Very much." And I thought that was... that light as burden, where you're the one that's pulling everyone. Belinda's the one that's pulling everyone. And I thought that was a really interesting metaphor.
Yeah. Anybody else?
Well, there was a lot of light versus dark.
Yeah.
And also, I think the how it kept going on and off and on and off, the instability of light or something, there was something there that I thought was interesting, how it interrupted things. You couldn't count on it. And then the darkness, like, of the cave, I thought, wow, that was dark, dark, dark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would say about the ending that Robert was doing a lot of writing.
That always drives you crazy, too. Like, that would have taken so long.
Right. Right. They had, yeah, like a 3-minute conversation over the course of about an hour and a half. And it was all very eloquent as well.
Hand cramping.
Yeah, it didn't quite work, did it?
Yeah, that was kind of the other thing that I rolled my eyes at.
It's weird that no one else would learn how to sign.
Yeah.
I mean, that is
odd.
Well,
Jacob was too lazy.
I suppose.
Yeah.
And Mr. NT was too
old. He really
was.
I suppose. I just found that odd. I mean.
And then the book just ended.
And then it just ended.
Right? Didn't you sort of turn the page like it's one of, every now and then you get a book like you turn the page and you're like, oh, did they forget
yeah.
one?
Oh. Yeah, right. Okay, well, now we have reached the point where we say whether we would recommend the book or not. Barb Shoup, what would you do?
Well, I did not find it a particularly satisfying read, but I think he's really interesting. I'm curious to know what he would do next. It would depend on who, you know? I mean, some people would probably find that a lot more interesting than other people. But for me, I wouldn't get all excited and say, you've got to read this book.
Yeah. That's very fair. Kate?
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's sort of like what I said earlier, where I don't think this book was written for me, but it was written for someone. And I'm certain that there would be people who would be able to get a foothold into this book in places that I couldn't because of their own experiences. And so, as you said, Mom, I think it would depend on who. But in general, it did not set me on fire. And it was not a book that I was real jazzed about picking up.
Right.
You know, like there are some books where I just can't, you know, I just don't want to go to bed or I can't stop reading. And this was not one of those books for me.
Yeah. Tracy.
Barack Obama.
Yes.
Wrong on protecting abortion. Wrong on what Napoleon could not do. I would not recommend.
You would not recommend it. All right.
All right, then.
We shall relay your opinions eastward.
We should just call Obama.
Yeah.
Let's call him like right now.
He's probably not big.
He's on Medium, I think. We can just message him. I probably liked it better than all of you, but I probably liked it better the second time I read it than the first time I did. I probably got more out of it, I would say.
And there's no way I would read that book again.
Well,
I sort of skimmed it. I skimmed it a second time.
I did get more. Yeah. I mean, I don't think it was a great book, but I thought the questions were interesting enough for me to think about.
I agree with that.
And I there were a couple of those little things that I loved. The opening scene I thought was just very memorable, and I really enjoyed
it. Same here. Anybody who could write that scene is probably someday going to write a book that totally hangs together. I hope.
Well, let's talk about some other books that we hope might hang together. Let's make some recommendations. Tracy, do you have a book recommendation for us?
I'm so excited about a book right now.
All right.
I'm reading The Rabbit Hutch by Tess Gunty.
Oh.
And it's full of oddball characters who surprise the show, but also feel complete and real and relatable. And I've just been delighted by this novel in a way that I haven't been delighted by a novel in a while.
An Indiana writer.
Yeah.
It's an Indiana writer from
the
South
Rabbit
Bend.
Hutch.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The Rabbit
the
Hutch.
The Rabbit Hutch.
Tess Gunty.
Yes.
Correct.
Thanks, Tracy. Sounds awesome. Kate, what do you
can
got?
Can I pick two? I have two.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, she's always been like that.
That's true. So the book I was planning on discussing was Burnham Wood, which we discussed earlier. I really liked it.
Yeah.
I liked it a lot. It gave me a lot to think about, and I felt like it did hang together. I'm not sure what the consensus was with Dan. And,
again, I think I liked it better. Jen Bingham liked it.
I really liked it.
I liked it better than Dan, and Susan really liked it. Dan picked it apart, and
But that's Dan for
me. I know it is. That's why we love Dan.
Somebody's got to do it.
I thought it worked. I thought it worked completely.
Yeah.
I loved it. I thought it was great.
I thought it was a satire, ultimately, and that made me kind of love it. But
I didn't feel that. I didn't feel it was a satire, but I can see why you would say that. Yeah. And the other one that I just love so much was Lessons in Chemistry. That was I was halfway through that book, and I texted my mom and was like, "Have you read this yet?" And usually the answer is almost always yes. But in this one case, it was no. And I loved that book so much that I sent her the Kindle for it immediately so that we would be able to discuss it. It just was delightful. It was funny and smart
and poignant.
Poignant. Yeah. And I loved that book.
Yeah, my wife, Becky, just finished it. Loved it. Loved it also.
I loved it.
The author is?
I knew you were going to ask me.
Bonnie.
Oh, God. I'm sorry, Bonnie. It starts with a G.
Bonnie G.
If only we had some kind of technology to look this up.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know what that would
be. We'll leave it to the audience.
Yeah.
There you go.
Okay.
Challenge.
Yes. And Burnham Wood by Eleanor Catton.
Yes.
Barb.
Okay. The Half-Life of a Stolen Sister by Rachel Cantor.
God, what a great title.
It is. And it is one of the weirdest, most delightfully strange and affecting books that I have ever read. It's basically, it's the story of the Brontes. But I cannot even describe how this book works. I mean, she does everything you're not supposed to do. She's hopping around all over the place. She does things like, she uses, like, she has them living in an apartment instead of, there's no mores at all. But it's so, she just gets it. She gets the different sisters and who they are. And Charlotte's just like, I need. And Emily's like, ugh, go away. So it's really different and interesting. And then I just finished one that I also really like, very different. It's called The Secret Book of Flora Lee. It's during World War II. It's about a couple of kids who get sent away to the country, from London, and then it's got a part that happens in 1962. It's very well constructed.
Yeah, awesome.
I enjoyed that part of it, too.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
All right, so this month I'm going to recommend a book that I mentioned to Tracy not too long ago, a book by an author I love, and it's another book that kind of grapples with the American dream and the Vietnam era in a very different context, and that is Dana Spiota's Eat the Document.
Oh, I've read that. Yeah, I like that.
It was a finalist for the National Book Award in 2006. It revolves around a couple of SDS-style radicals who were involved in an act of domestic terrorism gone wrong in the early 70s, and the new lives they adopt after the event. I'm going to also cheat and recommend another of Dana Spiota's books, 2011 Stone Arabia. That's just a pretty stunning portrait of a relationship between a brother and sister. So it's got a good tie to our book, too. And if you love music, it's really pretty special. I will endorse Dana Spiota, period. And I could probably even draw parallels to what Napoleon could not do with her latest novel, Wayward, which was out in 2021, I think. But yeah, Eat the Document and Stone Arabia, I highly recommend Dana Spiota. You can't go wrong. And that's it for us. You can find notes for this and all of our shows in the Radio Free Book Club blog, medium.com. Please consider following us and drop us a note on Facebook. Stream the show wherever you listen to podcasts. We are always interested to hear what you think about the book and our show. Our show is produced by hip hop legend and impresario Oreo Jones for 99.1 WQRT LP in Indianapolis. For Tracy Kumbe, Barb Shoup, Kate Shoup, and all the members of Radio Free Book Club, I'm Ken Honeywell. Thanks for listening, and join us next month when we'll see what we make of the first novel in more than a decade from the great Laurie Moore, called I Am Homeless, If This Is Not My Home. Until then, read a book.